Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time for another visit from our weather guys as we talk. We'll talk a little bit about Great Lakes weather and the whole Great Lakes region. We'll zero in on Wisconsin certainly too, and we'll answer your weather questions. And maybe if you've got a weather photo you want to send us, we've got a screen set up here in the studio, and we can handle that. With us today, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman back once again, former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW and also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to have you back.
Good to be back.
And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call with your weather or climate question, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@wpr.org. And, of course, send an email in, a photo as well, to talk@wpr.org. Love to have that as well. Your first time back on the show since the start of 2025. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the year that was for a minute or two anyway. The two of you write a weekly column, and in your column you recently answered the question, was 2024 an interesting weather year for Wisconsin?
I'll say every year is interesting, yeah. But 2024 in particular, I think it was the warmest year for overall warmest temperature for the state of Wisconsin. And it was one of the wettest as well, if I remember right.
Yeah, and the wet was May, June,
right.
July.
It doesn't seem that way, but snow on the ground now. But.
And then it didn't rain much for August and September, but it still stayed at the top.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. We had a tornado in February.
Yeah.
First time we've ever had a tornado in February. I mean, it's got only 28 days usually, but you would still expect that we would have had one at some point, because we have had them in January and March.
Yeah, and thunderstorms in February are not that unusual. They're perhaps as unusual as any month in the year, I guess I would say that from my experience, but they're not so unusual that you say, oh my God, I heard a rumble of thunder in February. This never happens.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen often, but it happens.
And we had thundersnow too, right? Wasn't that in December?
Or somebody reported. I didn't see it, so I think I'm recalling now the frustration of not having seen it.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
And here probably the big, certainly the biggest weather story is out in Southern California with the raging fires.
Yeah, the raging
fires.
Because
of the lack of rain.
Yeah.
When you look at precipitation maps of California, you can see Southern California is just dry, Northern isn't as much.
That's right. And, the background condition that leads to the Santa Ana-type winds, the offshore winds that are going to dry because they're coming down the side of the mountains anyway, that's climatological. It may be bigger or stronger or weaker in one year or the other, but that's not the factor, as you're pointing out. It's the lack of rain, and that accumulates, integrates over the whole season and leaves the fuel just ready to go.
Yeah. And now I guess there's big storms coming for parts of Southern California. So now the big worry is mudslide.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. You get a lot of precipitation. There's no vegetation there to hold the soil in, and you've got sloping terrain. It's not a good situation.
They're a great example of things coming in twos because they're directly related to each other.
Yeah.
We get some wildfires in Wisconsin, but they're different from those.
Yeah, they're different in a lot of ways. I mean, one of the things that the follow-up mudslides are less common here because we don't have the orography that they have in Southern California. So there's not trees aren't growing on the sides of really steep hills. Peshtigo Fire was a result of an extraordinarily dry summer, and so it happens. And at the same time of year in some cases, like it did then. But it's not as common here. I think we're just a little bit more protected from the long-standing sort of droughts. And maybe it's even the ecology of the trees. I don't know that, but I wonder if there's not something about the forests here that are a little different.
Yeah, I think some of the forests, Larry probably knows more than us about the sustainability of some forests, of some trees during fires. In fact, some require fires in order to seed themselves.
Yeah.
The Peshtigo Fire, I forgot about that thing.
Yeah.
And that was a really nasty.
The worst fire disaster in the United States ever.
Up till this year.
Well, maybe, that's a good point.
I think more lives were lost in Peshtigo, though.
Yes. TJ at Amherst has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, TJ. TJ, are you there?
I am.
Oh, okay. What's on your mind?
Well, warmer winters are changing things. And I was over at a neighbor's house helping him the other day. He's got a gray water system for his washing machine. And it goes way out in the backyard and into a big pile of rocks. And for the first time ever, that line froze. So is this going to be a problem again and again and again?
It might be. My guess is that it froze because there's no snow. And so the snow provides an insulation so that the frost depth doesn't get as deep and as cold.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting because it really makes the soil colder and the frost line go deeper. And while we've had some really cold temperatures, if we would have had snow on the ground, we would have had really cold air temperatures.
I think last Tuesday or Wednesday morning, whenever it was minus 13, I think it was Tuesday, it would have been close to minus 25 or so with a regular snow cover. And if it had been a fresh snow cover of, you know, a foot or more, it would have been even colder than that probably. That's a really good point, Steve. And it points out how contradictory sometimes the accurate and basic explanations for some of these weird things can be. You might say, wait a minute, the winters are getting warmer, how can my pipes freeze or a line freezes? It's because there's no snow, and you usually can count on it in the winter to insulate the ground. It's a great explanation.
My
and brother, who lives in North Carolina, they also had a real cold blast, and when he saw how cold we were, you know, he texted me and called me and just said, are you let you you know, your water drip out of your forest faucet, which I didn't because I haven't done that in many, many years.
Yeah.
But it got me thinking
what's
going on.
I know. Jeepers.
Well, yeah, and I was going to bring something up about that, and then it just flew out of my head. So instead of that, it'll come back. It'll come back. And in the meantime, TJ, thanks a lot. Let's go to Dot in Manitowoc. Hi, Dot.
Many years ago, the rules were the core of winter was January 15th to February 15th. Obviously, Mother Nature does not read the Farmer's Almanac. Has that all changed?
Well, before John says anything, I'll jump in. Nobody should read the Farmer's Almanac for forecasts. Having said that,
I suspect the almanac has not changed, but it's not an authority. But I think that's a really good rule of thumb that you just pointed out. That's about the month after the solstice, and that is about the time when you get as cold as we're going to be. Right now, to get more precise, we're in the week of the climatologically coldest week of the year. But I don't think we're going to realize it this particular winter in southern Wisconsin, maybe the whole state. It's just been an unusually warm winter, despite last week's cold. We're still running fifth warmest ever in the northern hemisphere and barely unseated from number two in the last 77 years. So we got plenty of time yet to still make that up. We may become the warmest or the second warmest ever. But even with our cold spell locally, not even close to a regular winter.
And I checked the 5-day forecast, and I think it's where Madison, for example, is set to be 50 degrees. Wednesday or Thursday, I forgot now. But
and I think as we warm up, I still think that our annual minimum temperatures is going to be this time of year.
Yeah, that's right.
It's still
going
to stay that way. It's just going to be warmer.
Yeah, and you know your point about the lack of snow, which can be variable from one year to the next. That is going to have a bigger impact, I think, on exactly what the minimum temperature is for a given cold season now. Because if you don't have snow on the ground, with that kind of cold air mass that we had, it could have been easily minus 30 and minus 13. Not piddly, but comparatively, small stakes.
And the point I was going to mention earlier was that when the frost depth, when you've got frost depth like that, and then if you get snows in the spring, then there's a lot of flooding.
Because when the snow melts, the ground is still frozen.
The ground is still frozen. Carol in Middleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Oh, this couldn't be more timely. I'm so appreciative. My husband and I want to fly out to Richmond, Virginia this coming Friday to pick up a puppy that's going to be too big, because he's too old, to bring home on the plane. So we're renting a car and driving him home. And so it's very much weather dependent. And I checked the route on the way back. I checked about six places. It looks like there might be some light rain. I don't see anything that says don't do this. And I know it's always, you know, you take some chances, but is there any site I can check or can you check or to make sure nothing, you know, unexpected
is happening? What's a good site for Carol to be checking? She's got a long range.
Yeah, she's got a long range.
Yeah, and you're thinking about a 2-day drive, Carol. Is that about right?
It's going to be 7 hours Saturday and then another seven on Sunday.
If you go to the nws.gov, they will probably, you'll land on the National Weather Service page, not a local office like Milwaukee or a place like that. So if you land on the nws.gov national page, one of the first things you see is a map with hazards on it. And if you can see on your route from Richmond back to Madison that there's no snow, there's no ice as a hazard, you can be pretty assured that you're not going to have to worry about it. Now, of course, if you look today, it won't give you a forecast for the days in which you're going to drive, and you wouldn't have great confidence in them if they're a week away. But if you're, you know, when you're just about to leave Madison to Richmond, take a look at that. That would be something that would set your mind at ease, I think.
NWS.gov.
I think it's NWS.gov. And if I'm wrong, it'll probably Google smart enough to say, you didn't mean that. You meant NOAA.NWS.gov. But whatever it is, I usually put NWS Milwaukee, MKE. So NWS space MKE. And even from there, you can get to the national page.
And then the other thing I'd look at is road condition maps You know, each state must have one. I know Wisconsin has one, and they talk about the road conditions. So if you're in one of those warning areas, that might be a good thing to check as well, see if there's snow on their highways or not.
There you go, Carol. Thanks very much. What's the turnpike that goes out east?
90?
I was trying to remember the turnpike because I was talking with a climate guy once, or a weather guy once, and he said, you know, if they'd have built that turnpike about 10 miles south of where
No lake effect snow.
Right. They'd have gotten rid of the lake effect snow, and they would have millions of dollars in damage from crashes, and that would have been avoided.
Boy, we used to drive when my family lived in New York, and Ann's family still does, but in the wintertime. And yeah, boy, we got hit with that lake of snowfall around Lake Michigan a lot, and it was nasty.
Yeah, so, that's long in the tooth, though, because you've got Cleveland, Toledo, Akron, Pittsburgh. They're all, Buffalo, they're all on the lakes in their big commerce center. So
I think Joel might have been trying NWS.gov and wasn't getting anything. We wondered if it's weather.gov.
Weather.gov, it might be that.
Yeah. Weather.gov. Maybe that's the one to give a try for if you don't get NWS.gov.
Yeah, sorry if I get the wrong address. I don't use the addresses anymore. It's like knowing your own phone number. Yeah, remember when you had to in the old days?
Now you dash post number one.
Yeah,
Our guys, they can't remember their phone numbers. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests today, the weather guys. Great to have them along as we talk climate and weather. And, of course, you could join in. The number's 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, with us from the UW-Madison. It's always great to have them come by to talk weather and climate. And Don in Iron River has a curious question. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Say, I attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I took a couple courses in meteorology. And how did you guys get involved
in the whole process? How have your careers progressed, essentially?
You know,
this is Steve.
I was not a weather geek. When I was an undergrad, I was actually really interested in physics and wanting to be a physics teacher, high school physics teacher, which my dad kept telling me, if you want to be a teacher, become a university teacher. But when I got into my senior year, physics at that time was all about nuclear physics. And I just didn't like nuclear physics. I wanted to see things. And so a fellow friend and advisor suggested that I take a meteorology class, that's applied physics. And I did, and I was like, wow, this is applied physics. And I can see it. And that got me on my career path.
It's interesting. We have overlap there. I was kind of a weather geek. but in my own way, not in the way that's kind of well advertised in our department right now. I never had an interest in forecasting the weather at all. I still don't really. But I had a morning paper when I was a boy, and I got it in 1972, I think. And so it was just after the moon landing. And I lived in northeast New England where we got pretty good snow, especially in the 1970s. It was perfect time for me to have this job. So I was the first kid out. My dad was a public school teacher. So we'd be waiting to find out if it was school on a snow day. We'd be up before all my slacker friends, and I'd get to put the first footprints in the snow. So I felt like Neil Armstrong. And I've never, ever forgotten any of those three things. And so they still get me captivated today. I was up today at 3 a.m. today talking to European colleagues about a field program for next year. We're doing a dry run right now. And having them all talk about the things they want to investigate got me stirring again. So it's great. I can't put it down.
Oh, man. Well, Don, thank you. That gives everybody a little insight into these two characters. It was great. Thank you so much. Richard in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I was a weather observer for the National Weather Service years ago, but so I got a pretty keen eye for the sky. And I noticed a study back when 9/11 occurred, and there were no airline traffic for a few days. They say the average temperature of possibly the United States or wherever they report temperatures dropped by an average of 6 degrees with no airline traffic up in the sky because they had shut down the airline traffic. And I'll notice when I'm ice fishing out on a clear blue sky and a few planes come by and the precipitation dissipates and creates a white opaque layer in the sky, that the temperature will drop out on the ice, you know, 6 degrees right away. And I'm just thinking that are current reporting methods even accurate considering the artificial pollutants in the air that are, you know, actually blocking the legitimate temperature down here?
So a couple of things. One is I remember that 9/11 study. They were looking at contrails because all planes were shut down. And there was a reduction, obviously, in the number of contrails. I don't remember a big change in temperature. Only because, and I wouldn't think it would be that big, only because they don't cover that much of the United States territorial-wise.
I think it was fractional in the tenths of degrees, and only overnight lows were a little bit colder.
Right.
I think, because I remember you telling me that, actually.
Right.
And that was done at Whitewater, wasn't it? UW-Whitewater.
Yeah, Whitewater. There was this researcher there.
So it was a fractional change, and I think it was only at night because the radiative cooling was a little bit enhanced. Right time of year for that, too.
Right.
Richard, there you go. Thank you for calling. Louise in Dodgeville, your turn. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I was curious about the historical data on the lack of snow in Wisconsin. Is this an unusual year or, you know, atypical, or has this happened before? And then wondering about impact of drought in early spring, just with lack of snow cover.
Yeah. Snow amount in a given season is among the most highly variable at a single station, one of the most highly variable quantities that I've seen in my experience as a meteorologist all these years, including here in Madison or any place in southern Wisconsin. I think there was a year in the, 1930s or the 1880s, a record goes back a long way, where there was almost no snow at all for the entire cold season. So something even worse than this has happened before. I don't know how common it is. There wasn't, we wrote one of our newspaper articles about this years ago.
Yeah.
I remember grouping them into four or five different categories, and the category of really under 10 inches or under 15 inches of snow was populated, but not by many winters.
Yeah.
And so it's not entirely unprecedented, but it's very unusual to go this far into the winter without any substantial snow, which is the case for us this year. It doesn't mean we won't end up with something close to average, but it doesn't look like it the next several days, at least. We'll get into February without any substantial snow.
Yeah.
And then the springtime, as we were mentioning earlier, the circulation pattern really changes in the springtime, and we get a lot of convective storms. And I think the real danger there, as we were saying earlier, is that the ground is really frozen.
Yeah.
And if there's no snow on it, all that precipitation will just run off.
Yeah,
the liquid precipitation.
And you waste
rain.
That water. So and even you if you're rescued by a return of the storm track, if the conditions preceding it are wrong, like they seem to be this year, you can waste it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was I was talking with Steve before the show started about a Washington Post article on how the map, weather map showing how winter is flipped upside down in the U.S. with more snow in New Orleans and Pensacola, Florida than they've had in Des Moines, Iowa, or New York. But at the end of that article, they did, the weather people there just, I think, not weather people at the Post, but who they were reporting on, said the jet stream is at a relative lull across the country, but that's not going to last. There's potential in late January and early February for another moist pulse of the subtropical jet, this time for the Rockies, Plains, and Midwest, and that could soon change as a result.
Well, we were talking today in our discussion for the field program that at least over the North Atlantic, the jet's roaring across the North Atlantic, and it's going to be an active week. We're going to have a lot of things to think about. Not so much over North America till maybe at the end of the first couple of days of February. So maybe a week or so from now, things might start to look a little different. And that might be what the Post is talking about. And they have a really good crew there. Jason Samenow, one of our graduates, runs the Capital Weather Gang, the Washington Post. And he's hired over the last 15 or so years a really good crew. So they do know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Really interesting. And your comment on the jet stream and jets, there was another article in the Post, it might have been in the, well, I know it was in the Post, about the jets going, the air, carrying people across Europe,
right now.
Going 850 miles an hour.
Yeah, because the tailwind is almost 200 knots right now. And it will be much of the rest of this week.
Jesus.
Sometimes happens.
So they're getting in a couple hours early.
Yeah, New York to London. You can sit on the runway as long as you want because you're going to get there on time.
Oh, man.
Just don't come the other way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No.
Louise, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And some open lines. You can get on at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. John in Port Wing has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, you guys. I'm pushing 82 years old. I've been a weather geek all my life. I grew up in the outdoors hunting and fishing southern Wisconsin from my preteen years. My question is there some way that we can – is there a – available online resource to follow the climate change thing, because it's definitely here. I remember it was traditional. We hunted deer to the weekend after Thanksgiving. The next weekend we went ice fishing. We usually had snow for deer season. I grew up around La Crosse. I now live in northern Wisconsin, been up here for 22 years, a throwing distance to Lake Superior, and we can't get snow. We can't get the ground frozen so we can run our trail groomers through the marshes. When we finally get snow, there's no frost in the ground under it.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there is the NOAA Climate Office, which gives a good picture of the U.S. Personally, I'm an avid follower of the Wisconsin State Climate Office.
Yeah.
They do a really good job of summarizing what's happening with our climate on a monthly basis. And looking about what that change has been. Steve and Ed are just really great work with.
And staying local is probably not a bad idea. We know there are some forces marshaling an assault against NOAA in Washington, D.C. And I guarantee you one of the things that would go first is anything that has to do with the climate. And it's dangerous and not responsible.
Yeah, it's disgraceful.
Relating kind of to the Great Lakes, John was asking about in the Lake Superior area. Glenn emailed to ask why Lake Michigan is not cooling. Glenn says he's been studying deep water temperatures in the lake, and they seem to have been increasing.
Hmm. I don't know.
I think it depends on when you're looking at it. I mean, right now, the Great Lakes are really down in ice cover, and the water temperatures are up. And so what that means, and that's the trend that has been going on, what that means is that the overturning changes. And so particularly in Lake Michigan. And so it may look colder at a certain time of the year, depending, like in, I may get this mixed up, but if it's spring is going longer, it may look warm. I'm going to be quiet. The lakeologists, people are going to call me up.
Yeah, but the point I think you're making, and I don't know the details either, but the point is that the water doesn't reside at the bottom of the lake very long in the Great Lakes, except Superior,
except Superior.
Superior has water that's sequestered for a long time, but not even Lake Michigan
does. They overturn, and that's how you get the ice form.
And back to climate change, remember Mel had emailed to ask if WPR or UW has limited use of the phrase climate change. Perhaps they've been listening closely. Mel hasn't been listening closely, but says he haven't heard mention of the extremes we're experiencing. Well, talking about it today, I don't think...
Yeah.
For WPR, I don't think for UW.
No, not for us yet. Certainly not for UW. I'm not sure what the current administration will be doing. I mean, climate change for many years was a bad word to use, according to some of the politicians. And I'll just say the Republicans in general. Mm. It's not just Trump, it's the Republicans.
Yeah.
But, you know, the evidence is so overwhelming right now, and people are beginning to see that evidence without even looking at the scientific data.
That's right.
So I'd be surprised if it gets banned. But then again, there are other words like DEI that are getting banned.
Right,
so we never really know where we're going. And again, that's not at the university. That's at the government federal level.
If you don't believe in gravity, don't let your kids climb trees. Right?
Joseph in Oxford, Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have noticed, and just an observation, I'm kind of a weather geek, that it seems like it's windier than it used to be. I lived in Kansas back many years ago, and the wind blew all the time there. And it seems like over the last 5 to 10 years, it seems like the wind blows here all the time. And today is another example of it's, you know, a nice day, but the wind's kind of taking the sail, wind out of the sail, so to speak. And the fact that it's kind of ruined a nice day with too much wind. So is there any kind of data that says that it's actually increased over the last few years?
Thanks, Joseph, for calling. And I want to just throw in Chris's email as well, because it relates to this, wondering what impact climate change has had on wind velocity. Chris is a long-distance kayaker and has noticed more days this past summer with higher winds. She's in Chris is in Door County and wondering if this is the result of greater contrast between land heating up versus colder water.
It's a standard variable that's reported at, you know, at a station like Madison First Water Station, maybe even the second water stations, every day. What's the average wind? What's the peak gust? So that data is available, and the fact that, and I don't patrol the data in that particular variable often, but the fact that nobody's written anything about it in the literature that says it's systematically getting windier or less windy at the surface makes me doubt that it is. So the absence of a report on that, which would be like picking an apple from a tree, it's so obvious if it were really there that I probably it's not.
It just turns out that last week I actually started looking at this question came up on a different avenue. And I went to the Wisconsin Climate Office site and started looking at it and looking for it, because I'll bet they have that data. Mm. But then I got distracted looking at other data that they have. But I'll get back to look at that, and maybe we'll do a column on that.
Yeah.
A listener emailed to ask if there's a correlation between less Arctic ice and a weaker jet stream bringing colder air to the Great Plains. In other words, are the frigid temps we're experiencing happening because of a warming planet?
There's a theory that is contested right now that suggests, well, first is an observational basis for the fact that the high latitudes are warming faster in the northern hemisphere than the lower latitudes. And that would do some damage to the pole to equator temperature gradient, where it systematically gets colder toward the pole, which fuels in turn the wind speeds at the jet stream. So the weaker that difference in temperature gets, the weaker the jet gets. That's all reasonable. And one would have that expectation, perhaps, given the observations of the warming at high latitude outpacing the warming at low latitudes. But my own work has kind of shown me that the jet has not changed its speed at all. It's just become more sinuous. And that suggests, paradoxically, that the circulation, the stirring in the hemisphere has increased in the presence of the warming. And I don't really know how to rectify that right now. I'm confused by it. So I don't know that there's really a definitive answer on this question. I have a feeling it's still going to have to be worked out in the next couple of decades.
That's really interesting because, as you're saying, it gets more sinusoidal. You think of that as more mixing.
Right, yeah.
And if it's warm or temperature gradient is less, you wouldn't expect that you would need that.
Why would you need it? Right. Yeah. It's very paradoxical.
Yeah.
And I suspect, you know, it might have something to do with what's going on in the overlying stratosphere, because things are a little different in the stratosphere during the warming. And so maybe there's a battle going on that manifests itself in this increased stirring in the troposphere, if it's true. Well, I know it's true from the observations. I just don't know how to explain
why. Yeah.
I can't explain it yet.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, with us today. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking weather and climate with our weather guys today on the show, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW-Madison. John's former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, of course, emeritus professor in the department. So great to have them along. And again, join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Jill sent us a lovely photo of a sunset. It's really golden.
It's lovely. We've been talking about this since it's been posted the last couple of minutes. It is so golden. What surprises me, though, is that the clouds that are associated, the low-level clouds, aren't lit up. And maybe that was the case, you know, a few minutes before the picture was taken. A lot of times at sunset, when you have low-level clouds, they turn pink and violet and things like that. And we're not getting here, which makes the yellow where the sun is really intense, which is really cool.
Maybe it's just about to happen because it looks like if there's a cloud edge through those trees that the sun has just come through, you know, and it's headed down, it might get pink and orange, pink and red next.
Really soon. Yeah. In fact, you can sort of see pinkish in some of
that. Yeah, that one
beautiful.
Tree. Yeah.
It's a beautiful photo.
It is.
Yeah, for sure. Jerry in Kokana, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, with the warmer temperatures, I understand that we get heavier rainstorms than anything. Anything we can predict for northeastern Wisconsin that you guys know of?
Northeastern. What's come into my mind is, you know, you got a lot of water bodies up there, and the Great Lakes are having less ice on them. And some of the researchers have been showing is, and we already knew this in different ways, it's just changing, is that as that water, cold air flows over those warm bodies, you get a lot of snowfall downwind of the lakes. And so I could imagine that getting more snow in the area.
With the right wind direction.
With the right wind direction.
So sometimes you get a whole winter when you don't get that wind direction. I think we're in one right now. It's kind of weird, but that's one thing. Yeah, And also, perhaps the summertime convection, like over the Keweenaw Peninsula, that's mountainous at its spine. You know, you have Superior and Michigan adjacent, and when it warms up over land, it produces a little bit of surface convergence. So maybe there'll be increased precipitation in that location in the summertime, and maybe it's already begun to occur. I don't know.
The Great Lakes, according to a new study, shows that the Great Lakes have lost an average of 14 days of winter per decade since 1995.
What's the definition of the winter
years,
that they're using?
If I remember the study, they were defining it by how much ice is on them.
It was from the Journal of Environmental Research.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's just hard to put the ice on.
It's hard to put the ice on. So spring is starting sooner and fall is going longer.
Yeah, so interesting. Wasn't it 2014-15 we had our greatest ice extent or maybe it was after that. It wasn't that long ago.
No, it was. They have 14.
And that 14. Coincided with the warmest year in the hemisphere's last 75 or so years. Yeah. So it's sometimes they're completely out of phase with each other.
Yeah.
Boy, it's interesting.
But this makes it all interesting. Right?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. And it did show, I think the research was also pointing out that the Great Lakes have lost 25% of total ice cover between 1973 and 2023.
Yeah. And that doesn't, I mean, the amount surprises me, but the fact that the world is global, but this whole area is warming, you would expect to see more light.
Right, I mean,
light.
And that's why for years on this show, we've been hearing that the Great Lakes levels is going down. I mean, you evaporate tons of water out of the lakes if you don't put ice on them in the wintertime.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the big factors.
Yeah.
Dave in Minocqua, give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the program. And I'm thinking about, wondering about controlling weather, and other than the little bit I've read about carbon capture or reducing carbon emissions, are there hopes or theories that have some possibility for future generations to in some ways manage not only climate change, but even influence weather favorably for farming and agriculture and things of that type?
Well, I'm not an expert, but I'll give you my opinion. My opinion is that the best we could ever hope for is to bend the trends in a direction that we'd rather have than what's going on. And I think that's especially true with the climate. If we can figure out some reasonable ways to capture carbon, if we can actually decide that we're going to try to figure out a different way to fuel our economies and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, not eliminate it, but reduce it, then we can bend the trend a little bit, perhaps, but it's still long timescales. But I have no confidence at all that we will be able to have substantial directed influence on weather, because the weather is just not going to stand that. This is too much. It's not a boundary value problem. It's an initial condition problem, and that effectively makes it impossible to fiddle with it, I think.
And it has a heck of a lot of energy.
It sure does. Yeah. Know, it sure does.
Changing things slowly, as we have been doing with carbon dioxide emissions, takes many, many, many years to change. And there's been a lot of work in the 60s and 70s, I think, and 50s to try and do weather modification. Mm. And it hasn't worked.
That's
it
right. It doesn't work. It does not work.
Which is good. Yeah. We probably would really screw things up.
We would screw it up. I think that's right. I mean, I think that's exactly right.
Right.
Somebody's interest would override somebody else's
interest, and you would take water away from somebody else.
Yeah, and you'd unleash a catastrophe.
Yeah.
Dave, thank you for calling. Dominique in Solon Springs. On to you now. Hi, Dominique.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm traveling to Great Britain for some road races in July. Is there a service in Great Britain that is similar to NOAA here?
Oh, yeah. The UK Met Office is one really good source for information over on the British Isles. And if not that, the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, the abbreviation ECMWF, is another place where they're centered in England. They're centered in England. So they will also have a lot to say about conditions.
What was the first one again?
The United Kingdom Meteorological Office, known as the UK Met Office.
Oh, UK Met Office.
Yeah.
Okay. Dominique, there
That's
you go.
That's weather talk.
weather talk. Okay. Dominique, thanks for calling. Brad in Fountain, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I was just kind of curious. I've noticed over last few years, like with NOAA's weather forecast, it seems like they're always trying to do an hourly update so you can never try and plan far enough ahead. And I'm looking at this more as for trying to do hay in the summertime. I remember 10, 15 years ago, I could look at a weekly forecast and kind of count on it. And now it seems like I got to check my phone every 60 minutes to see how they change. Because I can look and there'll be a week's forecast with no rain. And I'll go out and cut hay, and I look that afternoon, and all of a sudden there's a 40% chance for the next morning. And I was wondering if it's just a new trend that they're trying to appease everybody that just wants this up-to-the-date information rather than actually picking a forecast that they can kind of stand behind, so to speak.
Hmm. First thing I would do is check the apps that you're using. It may be the apps that are doing it, not necessarily the National Weather Service, because I don't think they send out weekly updates, do they? Or hourly updates.
No, there is a forecast model that's initialized every, I think, 2 hours now, the high-resolution refresh.
Right. Yeah.
And so in the summertime, I think particularly they like to try and run that because it can give them a little bit more precision on severe weather, they think. And sometimes, well, I'd say, I shouldn't say it that way. I think it is accurate, that it's an improvement in the technology that's available that's sort of compelling the use of or more frequency in the updates. But I think there is occasionally a problem between the actual source of the information, as Steve's pointing out, and the app on the phone. That is definitely true. Yeah. We ran into that last week in Florida. It was nonsensical. And so luckily I have other places I like to look see. And sure enough, those were steady as a rock. So sometimes it's the app interface, I think.
So, and what's the best app in your mind for weather?
I don't use them. That's not what I go to. I go to forecast panels on somebody's website. So Tropical Tidbits is good.
I go to the NOAA websites typically. I do go to Weather Underground.
Yeah,
I do have their app.
One.
That's
mm-hmm.
that's a private one, and that works pretty well. Mm-hmm. That's been around for a long time, which is probably why they do so well.
Right, I bet that's it.
Yeah.
Weather Underground. All right.
Yeah. So if you're carrying the phone around, you can get on the internet. I always use that instead of an app. So.
Ah, right. Yeah.
Brad, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Dennis in Blanchardville. On to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
First a question, and that is that I've been a farmer for 70 years, and I kind of agreed with Brad, the last caller, on how difficult it is or becoming to make an accurate weather forecast because we're cutting hay and stuff. But the first question is, if we're increasing the amount of heat in the atmosphere, which we are, wouldn't that create more energy in the atmosphere and therefore create more wind in general? If you create more energy from more heat, I would think it would create more wind because that, after all, that's part of the reason why wind is wind.
Not necessarily. The wind is generated by pressure differences. If you have no pressure difference, it doesn't matter how much heat, how much you warm the atmosphere up, you're not going to generate a wind.
Yeah.
I would think, though, that between the elevation, and the temperature changes, which is what causes high pressure and low pressure, I would think that then with more heat, that would affect that. That's what I'm saying. According to my physics, what I studied many years ago, anytime you have more energy, you're going to have more of a reaction. And that's the reason I'm saying that more wind. And then the comment is this, that as a farmer, wouldn't this be true or wouldn't this be better to have it so that normally they give an average, rainfall per year? But what really is important is what the rainfall is during the growing season. So I think they should have another statistic that would be more accurate in order to show people what is going on during the growing season, as far as moisture goes.
That's an interesting point, your later one there, and then maybe John will have comments on your earlier point. But to look at the number of precipitations as a growing season and then doing the growing season will change whether or not you're looking at corn or wheat or whatever.
You get daily precipitation amounts at all first-order stations and a lot of second-order ones. And so we've commented on this in our newspaper article just for this last fall. I think, so it's easy to get a monthly average precipitation. I'm sure that's available to be quoted to just about anybody who wants it from the local Weather Service office. I wouldn't doubt that at all. It may not be the headlining thing that you hear about in the news media, but I bet you can get it easily. Because we had in October, we ended up with an average October for precipitation as a consequence of one day that was extraordinarily unusual. And so that's a great example of what you're talking about, how the distribution over the month was nothing close to normal, and anybody who lived here knew it. But we had one really exceptional day, averaged over the 31 days, that 3.5 inches of rain made it seem like a normal October. So it's absolutely right that that's more important, is the distribution. And about the energy, I think maybe you're thinking about all the energy is going to be spent in doing a job. The universe is exceptionally inefficient. There's energy all over the place that is incoherent and does nothing for anybody, including in our atmosphere. It's about 99% inefficient. So, you can warm the temperature, and as Steve says, there's all manner of things that have to happen in order for that to translate to an increase in wind speed, and it's unlikely that that would be the primary result, and it hasn't been recorded as such.
You know, I wonder if, there are services. I was interviewing a weather guy who had graduated from here at the UW and has his own, he has a team of five other people, meteorologists, and they do specific forecasts for various groups. One of the groups is farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was thinking that as John was talking there about, this could be a good app, rather than go to the National Weather Service, who are already overstressed in terms of doing forecasts, have it a private industry go and grab that data. All that data is available. It's in the newspaper every day.
That's right.
And then just summarize it in a nice, efficient, well, and easy-to-use app.
I think the cranberry farmers have done some of that already. They've kind of figured out how to put some observational sites on their bogs and various things, because it's really temperature sensitive and condition sensitive. And so that's not in the purview of the National Weather Service. Yeah. That isn't their mandate.
Right.
And so there's room for private businesses to get in there and fill in the gap.
Yeah.
Machine learning or artificial intelligence, AI, is being used more to create weather forecasts, by the way. What do you think about AI as a tool for weather forecasting?
So two things I'll say, because I've been reading up on this after going to the AMS meeting. AI is being used in a variety of applications, and weather being one of them. Will it be good? I can see it in certain areas, like if you take radar imagery and you see a line of convection coming at you. I mean, right now, we fat finger that. When's it going to get us? Mm. There's where I think an AI application could do it, because their advantage is that they're really, really fast.
Yeah.
There's studies now where they're doing weekly forecasts. I think there are being claims that I think are being exaggerated. Yes, it is a lot faster, but they're based on current numerical weather prediction models. They need that data, and getting that data in an organized form is expensive, and it does take a lot of time. But once you get it, you can turn it on, and you make a forecast really, really quickly. That data also means that you have to have the extremity in it. And if your data set from the models is not accounting for climate change, then your AI models aren't going to be able to do it either.
I will add
this final thing, my final thought on this, and that is, as we start to compare, because we're seeing this coming out in papers, an AI model being better than the ECMWF forecast model. And it's good to have those comparisons. We'll all learn from that. But the important thing to remember is the best forecaster is the meteorologist, human who gets at that data and looks and dissects that data. And I worry with regard to AI, which are not physically based models, unlike the ECMWF and the National Weather Services. As you begin to look at that and apply it to your local region, your city, the good meteorologist is going to look at that model and try and see what's going on physically. And you won't get that from the AI. And so I think the local forecast will go down.
And one of the consequences of what you just said, the lack of the physical basis for the forecast, is that this was really interesting. First, I'll say this broadly. I have great confidence that our community is approaching this possible revolution very intelligently.
Yeah.
With expert judgment, as you pointed out, too. We're trying to make sure that we don't make mistakes and just go whole hog into this thing without thinking about it. One of the aspects that community said is, you got to be able to see why the model is wrong. There has to be a way to account for the errors. And in AI, some of the AI models, there's absolutely no such accounting.
Yeah.
And that leads experts to be very cautious about using them right now.
Yeah. And that'll take the human out of it. And that's the expertise. We want that human brain in there.
You have to have the expert judgment somehow.
On that happy note, we are out of time. And we're real. We're not artificial. And we know we've got to go. So our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, great to have them with us here today. And thank you so much for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.